Welcome to Our Story, a podcast where ordinary people share extraordinary stories. My name is Atherva, and today I'm joined by Caitlin Donnelly. Hey, Caitlin, how are you?
Hey, Atherva, I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. Man, our friendship is probably the newest out of all the podcasts I've done, and I couldn't be happier just because we got together through a mutual friend's playing kickball, and we just started talking, and like, it was weird how much we had in common, but like in all different aspects.
Yeah, no, completely.
Yeah, and I just found it very interesting. So I wanted to dive into that. But before we get into those specifics, you know, if I were to just get a little bit 101 about Caitlin, so, you know, you had a Wikipedia article or something. What would that first paragraph say for you?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this a little bit, and I actually went to like some Wikipedia pages of like famous people because I couldn't remember. I was like, isn't the first paragraph where they say like just when their birthday and whatever is? But no, so obviously that's where you tell people about like, you know, the big things you've accomplished in life. And I don't really quite feel like I'm there in my career. I hope that by the time that I am on a Wikipedia page, it says things like epidemiologist, global health enthusiast, you know, wonderful wife, all of these other very personal traits. But definitely for me, it's the focus on epidemiology and global health and a little bit of travel sprinkled in there.
Okay, that's awesome. And I'm glad that I think you're the first one to ever do research for my podcast. So thank you for taking it seriously.
Yeah, well, your elevator pitch sold me. So, you know, I had to do it justice.
That's awesome. So, the first word to use, I'm going to try to pronounce it, but I always butcher it.
Yeah.
Epidemiology?
Yeah. So epidemiology is the study of essentially diseases and how we track them and how they spread, which people did not know until about 9 months ago really what that meant. And yep. Now it's like I see my job description everywhere, and it's ironic because like you've just done, you know, people are still asking me how to pronounce it and stuff. So an epidemiologist is somebody who basically studies or works in the field of epidemiology.
Yep, makes sense. So give us an understanding of what that field entails. So for example, you know, when you went to school, like what did you learn? Like what did you have to learn more on the medical side, the logistics side, or, you know, what else does that field entail? And give us how that applies to like your work.
Sure. So you're getting me at a really interesting time because as we're recording this, I have just finished one job on Friday and I'm starting a new job tomorrow on Monday. So it bridges this conversation, I think, actually really nicely because it gives you kind of two examples of maybe what job outcomes are for somebody that's in this field. So I did my undergraduate work in the sciences. So I have a bachelor's in chemistry and then went on to graduate school in a master's of public health program. Within those programs, you can normally pick like a concentration or a major. So my major was epidemiology itself. Other colleagues of mine graduated with masters in public health in community health sciences, occupational health sciences, health policy. So the wonderful things about those programs is they're very interdisciplinary. You take courses and you learn a lot about how public health law works, which, you know, I'm like digging through my notes now to see all these things about is what CNN is saying about who has power over, you know, COVID-19. Is that really true? Like based on the public health law I knew. But what I really do, it's a culmination of basically like statistics and medicine and this other aspect of kind of the medical world with public health, which is instead of looking at an individual person and what's making them sick and coming up with a diagnosis, you know, that's kind of the medicine side of things. Public health looks at the system and says, okay, you know, we know that your teeth, if you don't get fluoride or you don't have these other, you know, strengtheners, your teeth can rot and that's a bad thing for your health overall. And so how do we improve like the general health of the entire population? So we fluoride the water systems in public health water systems. And that covers like a whole general prevention and kind of health promotion aspect. And it kind of, I like to think of it as like the lifting of all boats, that metaphor, rising tide lifts all boats. And so it improves the health of everyone because we do these interventions at a population scale. So that's kind of like the general idea of what public health and epidemiology is on a large scale. The more, I would say the niche area and probably the more frequently understood now area of public health and epidemiology is it's, and my specialization was actually in infectious diseases. So right now is kind of like my worst nightmare and my most exciting dream at the same time, because you obviously hope pandemics, infectious disease pandemics never occur. But at the same time, it's obviously like a once in a lifetime opportunity or once in a millennia opportunity potentially. So people who work in infectious disease epidemiology specifically, a lot of them work for like the government or local or state departments of public health. And so they're the people that are making sure restaurants are certified for, public health measures like hand washing and keeping food stored at proper temperatures to prevent things like E. coli and other outbreaks. And then they're also the people when maybe like, if there's any parents listening, your kids get whooping cough or something in the school, they're normally the ones that do the contact tracing and investigation of who's been exposed. How do we get them treated? Just kind of following their cases to make sure they can contain it as best as possible. So, a lot of people compare infectious disease epidemiologists to like private investigators because it is kind of like Sherlock Holmesy. You're taking pieces of information and kind of tracing down the ripple effects of maybe like one person becoming infected with something and like piecing all of these disparate parts of information together to kind of build the whole picture and try and control and contain something from there. So it's fun from like that investigative point of view.
Got it. Okay. So, top level view from what you described, if I were to summarize that as that role is basically tying the science, the medicine to policy. Is that a fair way to capture that? Okay,
Completely.
that's very cool.
And like at
Okay.
a large population scale instead of just seeing one person at a time.
Yep, got it. So what cases have you worked on specifically in your tenure?
Yeah. So the roles that I have had have been also within kind of a niche area in public health, which is research and guideline development. So I've held jobs at the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. The job I'm starting tomorrow is with the Infectious Disease Society of America, and I just finished a job with Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo. And in all those positions, basically, I was researching some kind of health topic that we know there are preventive measures for, or some way, like if it's a surgical procedure, some way to prevent things, bad outcomes. So I wrote some guidelines on preventing like post-operation infections in people with different types of surgeries. I also, looking forward, have a lot of projects at the Infectious Disease Society of America about researching and writing guidelines for physicians to implement about things like antimicrobial resistance. COVID-19 is going to be a big one, which is really exciting. They even have the guidelines for HIV exposure. So if you're a healthcare worker and you accidentally get stuck with a needle, there's all of these protocols that you can go through to ensure that you have this, what they call post-exposure prophylaxis. So you're, testing yourself, surveying. There's this injection they can give you to kind of stop that spread from happening right at the beginning. So yeah, so my role is really as kind of a researcher in public health to synthesize everything that we know on a specific topic that's out there. And then with the help of people in medicine, so actual physicians, we convene these working groups. We all work together to come up with these guidelines that are then implemented on a national level.
Got it. So you're the folks that tell us, hey, wear a mask, wash your hands.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, there's different groups that will handle that. So the CDC obviously is doing it right now. They're kind of the big, whenever you get into infectious disease epidemiology, they're the one that, like, you ask, you know, one out of five people, two out of five people are like, yeah, I'm going to work for the CDC. That's like the Super Bowl for epidemiology. So,
Got it.
yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about current times. You know,
Yeah.
COVID is pretty much ingrained in our world today, and it's pretty much dictating the new normal. So I wanted to get your input on you know, where we were to where we are, and you know, what the best approach is at an individual level and then at a larger scale as well. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
I know you partnered with a group that created an app
Yeah.
that created guidelines, so I wanted to hear a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you could give us a rundown of, you know, how the heck do we get into this scenario in the first place, and how do we get out of it?
Yeah. Yeah. And you touched on something that I'm really passionate about at the moment, and I will disclaim is not at the, not as we're talking today on October 4th, not, affiliated with like any major group in the United States. It truly is, like you said, we came up with this app. We're 30 public health professionals and public health creatives, so people that work in software design, programming, marketing, you know, at anything towards the kind of messaging of public health. And maybe backtracking a little bit, so my research in graduate school all focused on HIV and AIDS. And obviously that pandemic was not that long ago. I mean, it was the late early 1980s into the 1990s and even early 2000s globally. So not even, you know, we've been alive this whole time while that's been brewing in the background. And interestingly, there's like a lot of life lessons we have learned and probably should have learned from the HIV pandemic. One of them being, and one of the things I'm most interested in is this idea of harm reduction language. So, you know, you tell somebody you're HIV positive, here's what you shouldn't do, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Well, any kid who's been told, you know, don't grab the cookie from the plate of cookies that are sitting there, like, what are they going to do? You've just drilled it into their head that it's something bad they shouldn't do. And there's all this conflict, you know, of morals and ethics and stuff. So as public health professionals, they did a lot of research on this, and they've come up with this idea of like basically abstinence-only educations don't work. What it does is it drives things underground. And I kind of think that we're seeing that again right now with the overarching messages that really work. Like we've done case studies all around, you know, the world in Japan and Korea and even in Wuhan, China, where they've been dealing with this virus, that there are like three or four things that truly, truly work. Wearing masks, sanitizing and washing your hands frequently, social distancing, and making sure that you're in well-ventilated spaces. So based on those four principles and this idea of harm reduction language, this group of public health experts and I, we got together and formed an app called COVID Can I Do It? It is digital at the moment, so you know you actually access it from a website. It's not like a downloadable app on your phone yet, but you can plug in any kind of activity you're interested in doing. You know, do you want to go walk your dog in the park today? Are you interested in going to someone's birthday party? And it uses a lot of data behind the scenes. It's ever changing, so we pull down data from COVID exit strategy, which is basically tracking individual states right now to see how badly or how well is the state handling the pandemic. And based on those criteria, it gives you kind of like the stoplight colors, right? Red, yellow, green. And it tells you, is this one of the more safe activities to do based on those four conditions? Or is this something that you probably aren't even taking enough precautions just following those four things, and it's making you more at risk to either pass along COVID or to get COVID from somebody. And we really sat down and said, this can't be something that shames people. This has to be something that people feel empowered, that they're just looking up something they're curious about, And all the suggestions and language we provide make it so that they could potentially do those activities, but in a much safer way with all these other conditions that they're thinking about. So just to keep people engaged and to not kind of shut down and start ignoring the science behind it.
Yeah, that's a good point. For example, like in my scenario, you know, it gets boring to sit in your apartment and not do anything socially. So I'd rather have a safe guideline of doing something with friends, doing like the kickball activity we did. So this is a great tool, I feel like, for that. So at an individual level, you know, you could look at it, but then what about the larger scale? What is your input in it? And again, I understand that this is, you know, Caitlin saying and not representing any organization, but at a global scale, what do you think the way out of this situation?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it is just what we talked about. Like, need I remind people that HIV popped up in the 1980s, some may, you know, even argue late 1970s. We still don't have a cure for that. We still don't have a vaccine for that. 40 years later, we still don't have those kind of tools that everyone is banking on right now to get us out of this pandemic. There's a lot of innovation happening right now, and obviously big investment into finding cures and treatments and vaccines. But we know what can work. There are countries around the world that are reopening right now just because they had really high compliance with people wearing masks all the time, or with people trying to gather in small numbers or within kind of like these trusted family bubbles or community bubbles with their friends. And so like, we know that that stuff works. And I think it's difficult for me to explain to people like just how, because it seems so simple. It's like, well, can washing your hands really stop a global pandemic? Yes. Yes, it can. So it's, I want to hope, and I'm actually just thrilled and like incredibly impressed with the investment in public health that's happening right now. It's chronically been underinvested in for the past 20 years in the US especially. It's one of the first things state budgets cut normally. And so at the state level, people were really not ready in kind of our normal, what we would call shoe leather epidemiology, which is having the number of staff trained and ready to go out into the community and be able to do contact tracing and, you know, help people connect to resources on testing. So I'm really impressed with the scale of testing that's being done globally. Obviously, you need to know if people have it before you can kind of really tackle the problem. So testing is like the number one outside of just the prevention measures. We have some pretty good treatments right now, dexamethasone, remdesivir, which some people may have heard about this weekend because the president is currently taking them. Those are things that have been showed in guidelines and in systematic reviews to have good efficacy to treat this. But again, it's only a treatment, and treatments do fail. And so the kind of be all end all to end a pandemic is a combination of all of these things. But I think I always go back to this point with people, you can't understate or you can't overstate enough how well masks, socially distancing just helps to stop these things. And even, you know, we're entering flu season right now in the Northern Hemisphere. I did a lot of work in South Africa in graduate school and, you know, in HIV research and things. And we have seen, if you kind of follow the data throughout the seasonal changes that have been happening globally in Australia, in New Zealand, in South Africa, all of these Southern Hemisphere countries that have winter when we have summer, they had a record low flu season this year. Not because, you know, the flu vaccine is any more, it's a quadrivalent vaccine this year, but it's not necessarily any more effective than in previous years. It's because the same measures we take to stop COVID, wearing masks, washing your hands, sanitizing, socially distancing, also help stop the flu. So you can also kind of follow like the twindemic they're thinking may occur in the US. And I will say, like, I'm a little nervous for the next coming months just to see, because of the lack of, I think, people following these rules or at least differently enacted in different parts of the United States, that some areas may become flu hotspots as well at the same time, which is just kind of potentially a calamity for our health system. But again, yeah, it's just these simple things that people can do that really can make a difference.
Got it. That is, yeah, a very comprehensive yet concise way to summarize that. That's good. And you mentioned a word that I just wanted to know. This is just me being curious. What kind of vaccine did you say is
Oh,
coming up
it's
this year?
quadrivalent. So,
What
yeah,
does
what
that
it
mean?
means. Sorry. I also took Latin for 8 years in high school. So I forget that sometimes, like, there are words that I just like inherently know because of Latin. So, quad means four. So, it's a vaccine that basically tackles four different potential strains of the flu. And flu epidemiology, influenza epidemiology, is like a whole field in and of itself. But the nuts and bolts are, in the US, we're very fortunate that we have winter later in the year than, countries like Australia and South Africa and New Zealand. So what happens is they basically monitor what strains of the flu are circulating in those countries because their winter is like our July and August. And then we can build a vaccine basically to target those specific strains that are circulating globally at the moment. Flu is kind of a tricky thing because it has these proteins on the surface of the actual viral particles that change every year. They mutate and they're expected to mutate. It's just kind of how the virus works. So we have to redesign vaccines essentially every year to make sure that we're tackling the right thing. So it's like finding a lock and a key, basically. Yeah.
That's a good analogy. So now walk me through, and maybe this is not your field, but the process of developing a vaccine. You said for flu, we're able to do it every single year, but for HIV, it's been 40 years and we still haven't found it. Why
Yeah,
is that?
I will caveat. This is a little outside of my field, but I think I can give a high level enough explanation, maybe for some folks.
Yep, that's awesome. Yep.
And sometimes I think that works best with analogies. And if one pops into my head, I'll definitely share it. But so basically, when you're designing anything, maybe take the lock and key analogy that I kind of just mentioned. Like the virus is the lock, and we're trying to find the key that unlocks that. And the key is, whatever we put into the vaccine to do that. Some locks are designed differently than others because of the nature of just the kind of lock that they are. Same with the viruses. So, like I said, influenza changes every year. It's also just a different type. Your body reacts to it in a different type of way than it does to COVID or to HIV. So, essentially, what you're doing with vaccines is trying to figure out the right mechanism to get your body's own immune system to react to it or to provide the ingredients to your body that will then fight the virus. So there's a ton of different ways you can do that. There are some really great vaccine alliances out there. So pre-COVID, I mean, it's continuing during COVID, but there's an organization called Gavi, which is the Global Alliance for Vaccine Innovation. They have some incredible like primers on understanding how vaccines are made and why certain diseases still don't have vaccines to them. It's also just kind of like a technology problem on some level. There are two new technologies being used to develop some of the COVID vaccines that are out there. The long and short of it is, the new technology they're investigating is whether they can actually put genetic coding that your body can take up and start creating code out of it. So, the best way I can describe that for people who are kind of like non-sciencey backgrounds is when you read a sentence, I'm reading a sentence right now that says podcast link in it. Well, I know that the P and the O and the D, C, A, S, T, when you put that all together in a string, all of those individual letters, it spells podcast. And then I inherently know like what a podcast is because I've been taught about what podcasts are. So your body kind of does the same thing. It takes up all the individual letters that's being given to it in the genetic code, and then it reads it and it creates something out of that. Could be a protein. Could be different parts of the immune system that stimulates the immune system in order then to fight whatever disease or virus you have. So that's what is being done right now with vaccine development. To go into a history of why we don't have one for HIV would be incredibly long. But one of the things I think maybe going back to what we said before, and just in summary, is that vaccines aren't necessarily the be-all end-all. They are an incredibly important tool in our chest of things we can use to fight viruses. But we have all these prevention measures, we have treatments, we have potential cures that are not, you know, vaccine related. So interestingly enough, and it's kind of sad, there have been two gentlemen in the world who have been cured from HIV. One's called the Berlin patient and the other is the London patient. And the Berlin patient actually just died this past year, not because of HIV, or this past year, this past week, not just because of HIV, but because of a cancer, which is just really sad. But he lived to be the age of 54 when he had HIV as like a young gentleman. So, you know, we have potential other tools in our toolkit that can help us with these kind of novel viruses.
Got it. Yeah. So to summarize, it's basically the lock and the key analogy. The locks for some are, you know, it's easy to find the key, relatively speaking, and some it's more difficult and maybe you need more than
one key. Yeah, actually that second part is it's essentially what they're working on with COVID right now is we may need one or more keys, and then you may open the door and there may be another locked door behind that. So COVID potentially we may need two dosages for that. So it may be like some of the other vaccines that are out there, like measles, mumps, and rubella. You get a couple of, they call it like a series of shots. You get maybe two or three to give you the immunity that you need for them. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So we're trapped in this.
Yeah, honestly, right, that's where my mind went to when I said there may be another door.
Cool. Switching gears a little bit, you also mentioned in the beginning and in your examples as well that you sprinkled travel here and there. Now, as a person who loves to travel, I want to know a little bit more about that. What places have you, explored, and what ranks as the best?
So I did mention it actually when I was talking about grad school too. I was very fortunate in grad school to receive a fellowship to study for a year in South Africa and do some field research in HIV and AIDS. The purpose of my fellowship actually, so the research was only secondary. The purpose of that fellowship was to learn Zulu, which is one of the local languages. About 20 million people speak it in South Africa as a first language. And it is one of seven of their national languages. So I was also doing like just taking language classes while I was there outside of studying and studying epidemiology and doing field research. So I think that actually that's a really good example of why I love to travel is because I love people's stories. And that's why I think your podcast is so incredible, because everybody has this underlying story to their life. And sometimes you can connect with them in really incredible ways. And I was fortunate in undergraduate to be offered an opportunity to study abroad in Africa as well, in a country called Namibia, just above and to the west of South Africa. And so that kind of really sparked my recognition that there are so many global languages around the world and people have stories that are steeped in their cultures. I know that sometimes people, you know, use the words snow, like that the Eskimo culture has like so many different words for snow, just because that's something that's so ingrained to their people. And the Inuit, you know, I guess Inuit is actually the more appropriate term. And it's the same way in South Africa. So in Zulu, and I'm just retaking Zulu lessons, to revamp my knowledge of the language because it has waned over the last couple of years. But that's kind of what I look for when I'm going anywhere. So I'm not your normal vacationer. While I love going to the beach and, you know, having my little umbrella drink, I think it's actually just way more like life-giving to me if I go places where I can learn about the culture and hear the histories of the people that are there and kind of experience it for myself. I guess if I just broad listed where I've been, another aspect of travel is that you meet so many people from around the world, if you're just open to it, that then it actually opens doors and beds for you to stay in around the world if you want to go visit them. So I've been to out of South Africa and Namibia when I studied abroad. We did kind of like a 2 week trek around the southern part of Africa, the southern kind of countries. So Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Mozambique. Then I lived in this international house in South Africa and had friends from Germany and friends from the Netherlands, friends from China, kind of all over the world, South America. And one of those women ended up moving to Vietnam. So in 2018, I did an around the world trip from where did I start? I guess I started in Chicago, but it was Chicago to London, then to Durban, South Africa, which is where I had lived for a year, to be in a friend's wedding. And then was there for a weekend and flew up to Dubai and spent some time in Dubai for like a couple of days. And then flew to Vietnam to stay with my really good friend, who is living in the Hanoi area. And then from there on to Japan, just briefly, and back home. But that has been my latest, I think, big international trip. My husband and I got a chance to honeymoon in Ireland and Iceland, two places that I just like never thought of as being kind of on my cultural radar. And Iceland was beautiful. And I don't think we got enough time there, but just from like a geology standpoint, I would love to go back to kind of explore their natural climate. And yeah, I guess in January we were lucky enough to go to Belize for a little bit. So I did take a beach vacation after all. And that is the last time I've been out of the country until yesterday. I guess probably one of the things we talked about, and then I think you were like, wait, how is this possible? I'm talking to you from Canada right now because my husband is Canadian, and you and I met because I moved to Buffalo really recently, kind of to be closer to the Canadian border, which ironically has been closed since March. To a lot of people, but thankfully, because we're married, we do have the ability to cross and see each other. So we met in Namibia in that first location I told you, in a karaoke bar, like 2 in the morning. So sometimes you do really meet really important people in your life while you're traveling.
You pretty much covered the globe at that
Yeah,
point.
and I have there. We had planned for a couple of more trips, like upcoming soon, and I really hope that eventually we're able to do them. I just think that one of the key things that I tell people, like, I know 2020 has been hard on everyone and it's bringing out sometimes the worst in people, but I feel like people that have a really good appreciation and an understanding for like caring for their communities is because they've been outside of their small town or they've been outside of their state or even outside of their country at least once to just experience like how do other people around the world live life? Because there are 7 billion, if not more, people on this planet, and everyone has like these unique upbringings and stories. And to some degree, it like takes you out of this kind of self-centered nature that I think we're maybe taught a little bit in the U.S. And that can be good and bad for multiple reasons. But I don't know. I think that because I've been able to experience some of these cultures and just like make friends with people and understand, what they're going through, it opens up like a whole different type of dialogue that you're having with people.
Yeah, and honestly, my favorite part about traveling is, like you said, getting to know the local culture. I rarely go and travel to tourist places. I just want to experience what the locals would. So, what you did, especially in South Africa and Namibia, like you learned the entire language, and that gives you like a whole different appreciation for the culture because you could understand in the same wavelength of the emotions, the empathy. And more importantly, just the culture, like you became ingrained in it. So I thought that was very incredible. And the story about you meeting your husband, what was
Well, he was doing the tourist thing, just backpacking through.
it
But yeah, no,
about
again, that's kind of a fun, like, just cultures clashing story because we're both in Namibia for different purposes. His really good friend was working for this volunteer home that was housing students from kind of across the globe. So I had actually met his friend first through a series of other friends in my study abroad group. And they were like a household of people from Germany and from Norway and Sweden. So, ironically, I guess I left these off the map. Yeah, so I've been to Sweden and Germany because I visited one of the friends that was staying in that house in Sweden, and she let me like stay in her apartment in Stockholm. So I guess the point of this is like when you travel, make friends because you can stay at their places for free. So, and then the flight is just the most expensive part of your trip instead of hotel stays. But
Not only that, but then you have an in for like what the locals appreciate. So, you're not looking at an online app to figure out what's good. You just ask the locals, and that's where you get like the hole in the wall places that are the
oh yeah,
true essence
completely.
of
I
that
mean, and
area.
she was like in a suburb of Stockholm, so we actually would take the train. We flew into Stockholm and then we'd take the train out to like her neighborhood, and there were actually so many more cute places like in her neighborhood. Stockholm is beautiful in general, but yeah, you didn't get to know that like if you traveled outside of the city 30 minutes, you would see all these other things, right? Outside of what your little guidebook tells you. So yeah, but I guess going back to Ryan, so he was there meeting Andrew, who was running this house. They're both Canadian. And then my house was a group of Americans studying abroad. And the house that they were staying in was all these Scandinavian individuals. And so that was just kind of fun in general because, like, you would go out and just hear how, one, like, people perceived me being an American, and two, how, kind of how everybody interacted and, like, what their different stories were that they would kind of bring out, or we'd go karaokeing and people would want to sing these different songs, and you realize like this one song that was really obscure in the US maybe was popular with other people elsewhere around the world. So yeah, I don't know. And so we just kind of like sprung a friendship out of that. And then
What was the song?
oh
What was
God,
the song?
what did we I'm not proud of this, but it was to Toto's Africa. So yeah, so and then I
Your wedding song?
no, yes and no. It's like the song you do when you're like, at the reception and you've had a couple of drinks and it's funny. So I think that's like that version of that. The other one I remember is I think it was also because it was 2012, and it's the Black Eyed Peas, I think, sing it. Is it that song like I've Got a Feeling, that song? That song was like the most popular song while we were over there. Everybody would sing it like to open the karaoke night. It was just like, it was such a strange thing. It wasn't that big here at the time. I think it had kind of like passed. But yeah, I just have these like vivid memories of that song being sung. So
That's
yeah.
awesome. Cool. So, Caitlin, you're truly like the essence of this podcast. When we met, it was just like seemingly just any other person. But like you said, like everyone has a really unique story to share, like an incredible story to share. And I've learned so much through this entire podcast, not just about your field, about COVID, but also, like how you've embraced life as well. So if I were to ask you as a concluding question, if there was one piece of advice for me, what would that be?
I think it's just keep asking questions. I guess maybe that comes from me as like my science background, but I just think like 2020 is such a great example of this. Like people have these entrenched views, and if we just keep asking questions to each other, like you automatically create some kind of dialogue, whether it's about COVID, whether it's about, just what's going on in your life, or what's your background, what's your education about. I think that's kind of just what I like to keep challenging people with, is just keep asking questions to each other and kind of keep trying to learn and grow from those, which is what your podcast is all about, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. I'm inquisitive by nature, so this fits right very well with with my mindset as
So,
well.
and I mean, in 45 minutes, you can learn a lot about somebody, but there's always so much more. So I just love like the concept of this podcast and think that it probably makes people think about their own stories and how they would present them to people too, even if they're not the ones being interviewed.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And like you said, in these 45 minutes, I've learned so much more, but I want to continue this conversation after the fact too. So I appreciate your time and can't wait to hang out again.
Whenever that is.
There's a quote by Bill Nye that says, "Everyone you'll ever meet knows something you don't." And today, well, I learned a lot from Caitlin. And most importantly, is to never stop asking questions. Thanks, Caitlin.